This is Archie McLaren. When I had a regular show on KCBX, we called it The Wine Drinker's Guide to Indulgence. We don't do the show every week now like we used to. It doesn't mean that we don't indulge just as much. And we have the great contacts that we made back then, and that's why Christian Rogano from Niven Family is with us today, Jason Haas from Topless Creek, Daniel Dow from Dow Winery and Vineyards, I'm assuming.
Yes.
In the title, and Paso Robles. So we have an interesting conclave here, as well as we'll have some people on the lines today, and they'll be meandering in and out of the conversations. But one that should be on the line now, and I hope he is Jim Clendenin from Aubon Climat. Jim, are you with us?
I am certainly with you, Arch.
Yeah, what a treat to have you. In fact, you and I have been doing this for how long, 30 years?
Oh, about 30 years is probably the first time that we did it together, yeah.
Yeah. And then Brian Talley will be calling in, and Doug Marjoram from Marjoram Wines at some point today as well. So basically, gentlemen, what we'd like to do, because I understand that this has been an interesting vintage, 2015, there have been positive aspects to it, challenging aspects to it. I wouldn't know, because I'm not a vintner, whether there have been negative aspects to it. If there have been, you can share that. But knowing you guys as I do and knowing your expertise, whatever could consider to have been negative, you turn it into something positive. And so that's the way we're going to look at this. Jim, let's start with you in the Santa Maria Valley. And I think you also are pretty familiar with the terroir, which is just west of Highway 101 near Buellton as well, aren't you?
Absolutely. You know, that's where I live. In Los Alamos, in the Los Alamos Valley, we have vineyards there, quite a few that we're working with.
Well, why don't you tell us what the sort of the beginning and the evolution and the end result was from what you see where you are?
Well, you know, it's been a little bit interesting as the weather has gotten more chaotic, and the theoretical idea, which I'm never going to dispute, but I can't fully understand it or wrap my brain around it, of global warming is. In 2011, we had the coldest, most frost, most difficult flowering, and smallest crop because of cold weather that we ever had. Followed that up in 12 and 13 with normal years, meaning we actually started picking them at the time that we did for the first 20 or 30 years of our experience here, which is usually the first week of September. And in 14, we picked grapes 2.5 weeks earlier than we ever had before. And in 15, we picked 1 week in advance of 14. And for us, anyway, in Santa Barbara County, the entire climate situation completely changed. We had warm days instead of cool days, and we had really, really, really a 15-degree Fahrenheit change in nighttime temperatures. And the combination of those two things shortened our growing season. Normally, we have about 140 days on the vine after the buds push, and we shortened the growing season by about 30, 35 days, which is kind of weird, except when you think that our temperatures were more like what Napa and Sonoma normally have, you'd expect an earlier harvest. And so I think during that period of time we reached physiological maturity. I hope we did. And I like what turned out in 14, so I'm crossing my fingers that 15 is going to be exactly the same.
What's the predictability? You as a venerable now vintner, what's the predictability of the grape juice once the harvest is done?
You know, the experience that I have before 14 was nil. You know, the previous warm vintage we had was 1992, and in 1992 our vines actually started their push and vegetative cycle in January. And so I remember when Brian's dad, Don, told me that I should expect a very early harvest, but that was because of the earliness of our bud break. And so that was an August 20th harvest. And then in 14, we got to an August 6th, the beginning of the harvest date. And I was picking fully ripened, in balance Pinot Noir from Bien Nacido and shortly afterwards from Sonoma in the Russian River on July 26th, the time when normally, I don't think when Christian was working at making sparkling wine for Maison Dutz, I don't think he probably picked sparkling juice that early. It was just a crazy change for us.
Very true.
Well, with respect to Pinot Noir, let's use that as an example. What's the difference in what you dealt with in the Santa Maria Valley and what was going on in Santa Rita Hills, for example?
Well, Santa Rita Hills had very small crops, and they started quite early. I mean, some of the In Pursuit of Balance guys were out there at the same time we were out there, or even earlier, but they weren't picking 23-5 fruit. They were picking fruit at much lower numbers, looking for acidity to balance the rest of their fruit. And so Santa Rita started very early, and the real difference was in crop levels. It was a really tiny harvest down in the Santa Rita Hills, and the Santa Maria Valley was pretty much a normal harvest. I mean, I brought in within 2% the same amount of fruit that I brought in 14.
With respect to microclimates, Jim, within the realm of where you are a vintner, roughly how many are there?
Oh, golly.
I know this is a question that a lot of people will probably not understand. They look at the Central Coast and they'll say, oh, wines from San Luis Obispo County. Maybe they're different in North County from South County. Santa Barbara County, same thing, but there are dramatic differences all the way along the line. What are the ones that you see most?
Well, the closer you get to the coast down in the Santa Rita Hills, obviously the cooler it is, the higher you get in altitude, the more windswept and difficult, protected vineyards in the Santa Rita Hills probably have a chance of financial viability over the long term, but exposed vineyards are pretty much a make-it-or-break-it kind of a thing. And one year you're going to make money, and one year you're not. Get up to the Santa Maria Valley, it's a more sort of homogenous kind of a situation. Everything is on the east side of the freeway. Solomon Hills is supposed to be quite a bit cooler than the rest of the Santa Maria Valley, but I haven't noticed that. It's maybe marginally, fractionally, a little bit cooler. The entire sort of mesa that probably incorporates the Santa Maria Valley, 90% of the fruit that's grown there ranges from the Endocito all the way out to Sisquoc, and the Sisquoc stuff is probably a little bit warmer. The farther east you go, it definitely gets a little bit warmer, but there's not a huge difference between in the 10-mile stretch of where most of the vines are planted. Los Alamos Valley, where I've got vineyards, is definitely, I'd say the Los Alamos Valley could be a lot like the Arroyo Grande Valley, where they're just warmer, but still plenty cool to make really good Pinot Noir if you farm it right and if you have the right clones.
Well, given the microclimates, what are the grape varieties that do well where you are? We know Pinot Noir does, and in all likelihood, Chardonnay, we know that as well. What else is down in that area that is amenable to the terroir and the microclimate?
Pinot Blanc and Pinot Gris, the other Burgundian varieties, the great things, both Brian Babcock was a huge pioneer for Riesling and Gewürztraminer, and I'm now working with both of them, and I think those grape varieties do great here, and would like to see more of them, but you got to find a few consumers that like them too. I go around and I've been making Gewürztraminer for 5 years, bone dry, fermented in barrel, put through malolactic fermentation with natural acidity. It's pretty special stuff. Can't find it any place else in the world to speak of, and everybody you taste it loves it, and then they all look and go, but I don't know what to do with it. Nobody wants to buy it, so you're kind of stuck, even if the grapes do well in the microclimate, to finding a market for it.
Well, knowing you as I do, that's not going to keep you from making it, is it?
No, it just shows that I'm masochistic and I'm a little bit slow.
Well, fortunately, you're also gracious, and you share it with all of us, and we're really grateful. And, Jim, I know you've got a function you need to go to, and I think your dear friend and our longtime supporter, Doug Marjoram, is probably on the line right now. So we'll give you our best and hope you enjoy your function today in Au Bon Climat.
Thank you very much. And hey, Doug.
Hey, Jim.
All right. Have fun. Thanks, Art.
Okay. Bye. Take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Doug Marjoram from Marjoram Wine is on the line now. And, Doug, I'll embarrass you as I usually do when I will mention that 30 years ago when the Central Coast Wine Classic was founded and you and Jim came in a small pickup truck and slept in the back of that pickup truck because at the time you couldn't afford a place to stay. And now it doesn't seem to be an issue, does it?
No, we've grown up a bit, and things have moved in the right direction, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it was great having you that first year, and it's wonderful to have you continue with us. It's always a treat to be in your presence. And I wondered if you would describe the kinds of wines that you're making, and then we'll meander into the microclimate, the terroir, and that sort of thing, and discuss what happened with the harvest with you this year.
Well, I make a lot of wines because my mentor, Jim, does as well. But I focus on two main regions, Happy Canyon of Santa Barbara for Sauvignon Blanc, and that's my largest production wine. And then I work with pretty much all five of the microclimates to make a Rhone red blend called M5, which is a blend of Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, Tinoise, and Cinsault. And I make a lot of single vineyard Syrahs. That's the primary thing I make, but I also make Riesling from Kikkon, where Jim gets his Riesling from. We work in Los Alamos, we work in Santa Maria, we work in Ballard Canyon, Santa Rita Hills, Los Nuevos Foothills, and Happy Canyon.
In Happy Canyon, it's an area that a lot of the people on the Central Coast aren't aware of because it was sort of a late bloomer, no pun intended. And you were one of the people that put it on the map. How did people figure out that that was going to be a really special location for grape growing?
Well, the people I work with, Happy Canyon Vineyards, the vineyard was actually planted by the Behringer folks about 16 years ago, because they identified that soil set and that climate as being particularly good for Bordeaux varietals. And that's been pretty much the what everyone else in that area has planted as well, Bordeaux varietals being Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Petit Verdot, and Malbec, and then the accompanying white varietal Sauvignon Blanc and a little bit of Semillon. Happy Canyon Vineyard has been making those wines for 13, 14 years now. But Behringer actually came in and planted that first vineyard, and that was followed by, and I'm not sure if this is in chronological order, by Vogelsang Vineyards, Grassini Vineyards, Star Lane Vineyards. Now it's called Crown Point Vineyards, which is the old Three Creek Vineyard, and then McGinley Vineyard, which was the old Westerly Vineyard.
Well, that's a remarkable array now. That happened in a hurry.
It sure did. There's not a lot of plantable acreage there. Once you come from San Ynez Valley on Armor Ranch Road, which intersects the Happy Canyon Road, you sort of cut through this very large mesa, and you get into a completely different watershed. The soil sets are completely different there, and that mesa blocks off a lot of the maritime influence back to that area. And then there's a very short part of that valley, which is sort of a combo pack of maritime and high desert, where it quickly turns to chaparral. And in that little pocket there, Bordeaux varietals seem to be doing very, very good. I quite honestly have been standing at Westerly Vineyards in my Sauvignon Blanc section, and have felt swirling on my back of my neck, warm wind, and on the front of my face, cool wind. It just seems to be that perfect little spot where those two climates meet, and we really get some exceptional grapes out of there, especially for Sauvignon Blanc. We are able to, and Sauvignon Blanc is one of those grapes that is very climate specific. If it's grown in too warm a climate, the grape sort of becomes sort of more melony and cantaloupe and get some tropical fruits. If it's grown in too cold a climate, like we've seen with cold maritime climates like in New Zealand, it gets very citrus, grapefruit, grassy, and develops those kind of flavors. But in the perfect climate, which is where I think Happy Canyon fits that bill, we get perfectly ripe Sauvignon Blanc without a lot of sugar, and therefore the potential alcohols are lower, and you get these beautifully balanced Sauvignon Blancs that are from what I, from my standpoint, from a restaurant background, just the kind of wine I look forward to have at the table.
Well, based on your Rhone varietal wine, where in the, is it probably near Los Olivos somewhere, I'm guessing. Where do you get those grapes? Where are they planted?
Los Olivos, you're right, is the epicenter. And it's all from around there. But we go, you know, we go as far north as Colson Canyon Vineyard, which is just off of Tepescate Canyon, and it goes up to Colson Canyon. And then we get fruit from Parisima Mountain Vineyard, which is in Ballard Canyon. And then we get a lot of Syrah and Grenache from Santa Rita Hills, John Sebastiano Vineyard. And then as well from probably the easternmost vineyard, we get some of the we had planted for us some of the first plantings of Cunoise and Cinsault that we get from Camp 4 Vineyard.
Well, it always fascinates me with respect to blending various grape varieties. And I think of the five primary Bordeaux varietals constantly, and there are people in this room like Daniel who's really familiar with those. And also Jason, who's extremely familiar with the Rhone varietals. How did you decide to blend the five Rhone varietals into one unit, M5? How did you say, well, but maybe I need a little Cinsault in this, or maybe I need more Mourvèdre? How did you come to that conclusion?
My light bulb wine, which I think every one of us has if we're interested in wine, it's that one wine you drink and listen to go, hey, wine's important. There's something more to this whole thing than I thought. My light bulb wine was visiting Chateauneuf du Pape as a long-haired, pimply-faced little brat with my parents. And I went into a cellar at Clos du Pape, and we walked down into the cave, and I was handed a tasse de vin in order to taste the wine, and the winemaker was taking the wine out of the barrel with a wine thief and putting it into the tasse de vin, and I was tasting it. And in this unbelievable dark, you know, moldy cellar, it was quite dramatic. And a couple things happened. One, I liked my parents a lot more, which was good. And then secondly, I loved these flavors. They were just I'd never had these kind of flavors before. And even at that young age, I got into tasting wine, and my parents got into wine at that point, and I'd accompany my dad down to Vendome Liquors in Los Angeles, and I would buy my own bottles of Chateauneuf du Pape and keep them in my room, and they aged very quickly.
I'm sure.
I lived in the San Fernando Valley. but I would open them up for special occasions, and so then when I got older and was working either cooking or serving in restaurants, I was always the guy who knew a little bit more about wine than everyone else, and I studied wine and drank wine and tasted wine, and then after graduating from school and opening Wine Cask in Santa Barbara, traveled often to Chateauneuf du Pape and tasted wine out of the barrel, and I really became convinced that those two sort of unknown varietals were really going to set my style of wine. If you taste those wines varietally, sometimes, and people do when they come to the winery, say, you know, why do you make this? Cunoise almost smells like Jolly Rancher watermelon candy, and Cinsault oftentimes has a sort of almost earthy, dirty flavor to it. But as little touches, as little additions to the wine, they add a complexity and an interest to the wine that I don't think I would get from just using Syrah, Grenache, and Mourvèdre. It adds a spice element and a stealing from Jim Clendenin comment. It adds a little je ne sais quoi. You get this I don't know what, because you stick your nose in the glass, you swirl it, you go, there's something interesting there. What is that? And you keep looking at it, keep exploring it, and keep tasting it, and keep drinking it. And I thought, without those two varietals, what I was setting out to do would not be possible.
Well, based on the climate this year, the odd, extremely unusual situation that you dealt with, give us a little bit of the evolution of what happened for you this year.
Well, luckily we were in town and we were sampling and visiting a lot of the vineyards we were working with and noticing that there was early ripening. We picked our first Sauvignon Blanc on August 2nd, earliest on record. I usually pick in late August or early September the majority of Sauvignon Blanc. We were done with the entire Sauvignon Blanc harvest before the end of August. It was fast. It wasn't furious. I mean, the temperatures were not really spiking at that point. We were able to get everything in a fairly controlled manner and not get an excessive amount of ripeness. But then what happened is everything else ripened at the same time, which would have been normally difficult, except that my vintage was down about 50%. Many of the Syrah vineyards we were working with, a couple, we didn't pick anything at all. It was less expensive for the vineyard owner to not pick it than to pick it, and we let a couple of vineyards just hang. So normally I do five single vineyards of Syrah and a wine called Uber, which is a co-fermentation, all five of those single vineyards. And this year we're not going to make Uber. Uber usually co-ferments for about 60 days because we have Syrah in so many different microclimates. We're only going to have a few single vineyard wines. Syrah really, really got hit hard, and we just have very, very little of that to
Same issue in Happy Canyon. I'm assuming that's somewhat different.
Yeah, Happy Canyon didn't seem to have the problem that the Rhone varietals did. We got a fairly we were down on Sauvignon Blanc about 50%. But it wasn't whole vineyards where things were just wiped out like it was with Syrah. But it was hit and miss. You know, we work with a vineyard called Black Oak, which is a vineyard I've been working with since the beginning, since 1981. And, no problem at all. everything came in a good quantity, very high quality, and they had a really good set. But, the set for most of the Syrah that I work with, was devastating and there just were no grapes.
Well, we're sending you our best wishes on those, irrespective of that, Doug. We'll call it healing energy at this point. But I know the wines will be special. There's no question about that. And thank you for taking the time to call in. It's very gracious of you. We have Christian Rogano from Niven Family here. We've got Jason Haas from Tobless Creek. And we got Daniel Dow from Dow Vineyards and Winery. And we're going to be moving along. And as we speak to people here and within the studio, we'll probably have Brian Talley calling us at some point to tell us what's going on in Arroyo Grande or what did go on. Thank you again, Doug. All the best to you.
Thanks, you guys. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Doug.
Which one of you gentlemen would like to lead into the next part of this discussion? If we're going south to north, Christian, that would probably be you, okay. Wouldn't it?
Yes, indeed.
And pronounce Rogano for me, so I'll get it.
Yes,
right.
You're one of these few people in the Central Coast that doesn't butcher my last name, Rogano. Rogano.
Okay.
Very good.
Right,
yes.
Got it.
Well, it was my 30th harvest in the Central Coast, so that, you know, gives me some knowledge. I get some knowledge about it. And it was very unusual year, so to speak. And what I'd like to do first is maybe kind of recap the weather we had in the Itna Valley. As you know, in the Itna Valley, we're making a few labels, like Jim and Doug as well. We have the Tangent, mostly white wines. We specialize on white wines. We're going on a Tangent with Albarino and Grenache Blanc and Viognier, another varietal Pinot Gris. And then we have our Belliana, which is the wine that we're mostly known for, which is our Burgundian brand, Chardonnay Pinot Noir. And we have some very small offering too, another brand called Zarker, which is a Gruner Veltliner. You have to be very courageous to grow that varietals because nobody knows what it is. And then we have also Transa, a very small blend for the tasting room, but a fairly large project called Trumith. And Trumith is actually two particular wine. One's the Estate, Paragon, Etna Valley Chardonnay, which we've been growing for more than 40 years, and also Cabernet from Paso. So those are the wines we're producing down at the winery in the Etna Valley. And we are all estate except for the Cabernet. So it's everything you'll taste when you come to visit with us is basically the Etna Valley, Paragon and Fire Peak. So to rewind a little bit, it was a very unusual year, and this year was almost the 15, almost identical at 14 and somewhat similar to 13. What I mean by that, in December, January, and February, we had almost like fall weather. We had in the Etna Valley 91, 92 degrees temperature recorded in January and February. And then we got into spring, winter, I should say, during spring. So we had in the Etna Valley, we didn't reach really over 72 degrees in the month of May. And that was really a challenge for the bloom. So this explained, obviously, during set that the crop was small. We knew that just by looking at the set. Try to explain to our listeners, when you look at a cluster, instead of having, let's say, 45 berries, you only had about 20 because the other 20s really didn't have the proper fructification, so they basically stayed at the stage of very, very tiny berry, and then as the weather warmed up in June, they just fall to the ground, so the crop was a lot smaller. And then we had a fairly cool summer, June, July, and for us, we almost call it spring this year. And it was very similar to last year. And then we had a very warm September in the Etna Valley. In fact, during the entire duration of harvest, we had 26 days when we reached 90 degrees, and 12 to 16 of them we reached between 95 and 97 degrees. And that really was unusual. So what it did to it, it's made a very early harvest, a very similar situation what we saw in Santa Barbara County. We started on August 21st, when we normally harvest, I would say around September 10th, it's the start, so quite early. And the biggest challenge, and to me, if you had to resume the vintage in one sentence, I would say this is really the vintage of the grower. And the reason for that is it was very difficult to make picking decisions, because when you have a small crop and quite a bit of heat, there is a fairly fast increase of sugar, bricks, obviously, going up. So the sugar concentration goes up, and then you may not have yet the physiological ripeness, the phenolics, having the skin that's become more chewy, that lost its greenness, the seeds ripening, became more brown, more polymerized. So we had to water, obviously, the vines to try to delay the ripeness, gain more days. And then I really noticed that typically you have, I would say, close to a week when the grapes are ready to be picked. But this year was really condensed to 3 days. I mean, you really, if you did not nail the picking decisions, you may not have the best wine. And the reason for that is because, of, once again, that weather was more capricious. And so it was very challenging. The other thing, too, which we did, because we looked at the forecast and we saw that the September was expected to be very warm, we left a lot of leaves on the vineyards, particularly with Albariño and Sauvignon Blanc. And the reason for that is, if you ever had the chance to talk to a winemaker and this winemaker explained to you that if you take a thermometer and you insert the thermometer inside the berry, outside the canopy, or inside the canopy under the foliage, you have about 12 to 15 degrees Celsius difference. And it's very important for some varietals like Sauvignon Blanc and Albariño, for instance, because those have a strong varietal character. And if the fruit gets too hot, you lose actually some of those flavors. They actually break down. So it was very interesting. We had the canopy on those varietals all along the harvest, and simply 10 days before picking, we went to the vineyards, in particularly in the case of Sauvignon, and stripped 60% of the leaves. Every single block of Sauvignon Blanc, we did that. So we preserve, the fruit didn't get as hot because of the strategy of canopy management and timing of leaf pooling. Same thing with Albariño. So it was a very technical harvest, so to speak, we had to deal with. Yield, we're down 20 to 30%. I'd say overall the reds are slightly a little bit lighter in color than the previous vintage, 14, but they're very full and round. And the reason for that, it's kind of more characteristic of a warm vintage. When you taste, you know, Pinot Noir from Burgundy from 03, they're very round and full, they have a little less color. So this is a warmer vintage. So it's a full-bodied, rich, more spectacular wine. Probably one that won't age as well because the pH got a little bit lower, the acidity a little bit down because, you know, acidity is metabolized into sugar with heat. Interesting harvest, financially a struggle, and certainly different wines than we had, like Jim mentioned earlier, at 10, 11, and 12.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was at the Wine Spectator Wine Experience this past weekend, and they served, when they introduced Eric de Rothschild, they served a 2003 Lafite at that particular instance. And is a tremendous dichotomy in the way people who are collectors look at a vintage like that, which is overly warm, than they do in one like 2000, which or 2005, which are much better balanced. Daniel will probably talk about this as we go along, since he's a Bordelaise kind of guy, and he also speaks French, as I heard. Yeah,
and so is Jason.
Yeah, and so does Clendenin, and who knows? Maybe Brian Talley does too. At any rate, give me a little bit of an idea about how you feel that the vintage that was so warm will show in the bottle and age.
Well, if we didn't have 40 years of grape growing into the Itna Valley, and if we didn't have the chance to be, you know, worked in many places around the world, New Zealand, France, and so we really had a good understanding of what to do in those conditions, so we made the right decisions. But if you're less experimented, I think it could be more challenging. Say some people may have, you know, it may be more difficult for them. But if you have the knowledge, you're more comfortable, and you made the right decisions. What I would say is the ones are going to be full-bodied, round, big. The whites are more tropical, more pear, pineapple, peach. They are be more Californian than European style, I would say. A little bit less acidity, but they'll be showing very well, very rapidly. So this is not a vintage to put away if you're a collector, but this is a wine that you buy, and within a few months of release, you got a very spectacular Californian-style wine. So very pleasing. I think the public will be very pleased with those wines. They're going to be very, very easy drinking. To me, they are, I mean, the Chardonnay, for instance, is a good example. We have 700 acres of Chardonnay. They're so huge and big and lush and tropical and round and creamy. And we put some big oak on it. We have the vanilla, a bit of cinnamon. They're just very, they're like a nectar, so to speak. But they won't have the longevity. This is, once again, this is not a collector's item, but they'll be a crowd pleaser.
I just had a twinge of hunger and thirst, Christian. Thank you for sharing those descriptions. We have Brian Talley on the line, I believe. Brian, are you there? I don't hear
you. Yeah,
oh, there
hearing,
you.
Hearing Christian describe Chardonnay made me very thirsty.
Yeah, I understand, totally. Brian Talley is the owner and operator of Talley Vineyards and Winery in Arroyo Grande. It has become an iconic winery over the years, a fabulous location, wonderful people. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you, Archie. It's always wonderful to chat with you.
Give us a little bit of an idea of what transpired for you folks down at Arroyo Grande during this 2015 harvest.
Well, I guess in two words, it was early and very light. And those are kind of the overarching themes that I'm seeing. And, you know, we've tasted through the cellar, and our wines are not nearly as expressive at this point as I heard Christian describe. So I'm not quite so sure that I guess I can say where things are really headed.
Maybe you're enthusiastic, Brian, but you're not effusive like Christian is.
Well, maybe I'm a farmer. Maybe I'm just a little more conservative by nature, but I'm very pleased with what we're seeing, though I do wish that there had been more.
When you run into an issue like that, and I'm sure that we'll get into it with some of the other discussions as we go along this afternoon, how do you deal with that from a financial standpoint?
Well, I mean, one of the most important things is with wine is really being able to project ahead. And it's critical for us to maintain inventory of some of our really critical wines, our Estate Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Those are the winery's signature wines. And we know now we will have a very short 2015 vintage. And so, quite frankly, we probably want to slow down our sales cycle on the 2014s to make sure that we don't run out of wine.
Does the price change?
I think the price is going to go up a little bit, and our wines in coastal San Luis Obispo County represent some of the very, very best values in the marketplace. And quite frankly, I think there's room to increase pricing a little bit.
when you have predominantly Chardonnay and Pinot Noir on your estate property, what is the difference between their ripening during a vintage like this, and which one do you pick first, and the hot weather is beneficial or not beneficial on which one?
Well, I mean, in general, I prefer cooler vintages. I like a more classic style where we have a little bit higher acidity. You know, I think that Christian touched on the fact that this could very likely be an earlier developing, you know, less age-worthy vintage. We typically start with Pinot Noir, though increasingly there's a lot of overlap for us between especially young vine Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And for the first time in our history, it actually kicked off before the 1st of August. And that was a surprise.
Before the 1st of August, wow. Well, actually, Clint Denon mentioned that too, I believe, didn't he?
Yeah,
it is surprising, isn't it? Have any of you fellows ever dealt with anything like this before? Have you done that, Jason?
Well, we actually weren't that early up at Tablas Creek. We started our harvest on the 26th of August, which was a full week later than in 2014. And I feel like there was a real kind of climate difference between south of the grade and going south down into Santa Barbara County, and then north of the grade and going north. I mean, if you look at the degree days for us, up until the beginning of September, we were about average. It wasn't a particularly warm year. It had alternated between warm stretches and cool stretches, which Christian mentioned. We had a warm start to spring, which got things off early. And then it got really chilly in May. And then it warmed up again in June. And then it cooled down in July. It warmed up the second half of August and has basically been warm from then until about a week and a half ago when it's kind of moderated. But overall, what that's meant is that the ripening for us happened kind of in steps. You would get a burst of ripening, and then it would slow down. Then you get a burst of ripening, and then it would slow down. And we see that, yes, we were a little earlier than average if we look at our 10-year average, but it's also taken a really long time to go from the beginning of harvest to the end of harvest. We finished our last pick today. It's 71 days between the beginning and the end of harvest, which
is... And what's normal?
Normal would be about 60.
I see.
So it's stretched out a lot. And there was a real impact also in the yields that we saw. The stuff that sprouts earlier, which in the Rhone world for us are things like Syrah and Viognier and Marsan and Grenache Blanc, that was flowering in May when it was cold and windy and a little bit wet, and the yields on those were off a lot. I mean, like for us, 40 to 50% down.
Wow.
The things which sprout later, like Roussanne and Mourvèdre and Coonoise, and were flowering in June, were down a lot less, like in the 10 to 15% down. Mm-hmm. So in that way, having this pretty wide range of grapes that sprout at different times, that flower at different times, and that ripen at different times, actually acted as a little bit of a buffer for us against some of the unusual conditions.
It's always been fascinating to me since Tablas Creek came here and established such an incredible reputation and for the vines that you provide for other people as well as for your own property. How in the world you can keep up with when to do what with what? I mean, it's just remarkable what you've accomplished. So, I mean, for example, I'm assuming that each one of those things is picked in a different time.
There's a lot of overlap, but you sort of know, you know what's going to start things off. You know you're going to start with Viognier and going to move into Syrah and Marsan, and then you'll have a long stretch where you'll be harvesting a few things like the last of the Syrah and the Grenache Blanc, and you're probably the first of the Grenache. Mm-hmm. And as it goes later in the year, the early things finish up and the late things start up. And by the time you get to the second half of October, you know you're basically going to be looking at those last blocks of Mourvèdre and Roussanne, whose leaves are just barely hanging on to a little bit of green, and you're just hoping for enough heat to to get things to the place that you want them.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, Chateau Neuf du Pape, that 13 grape varieties are legal in order to put in one bottle of wine, and not all of them are red for a red Chateau Neuf du Pape. Do you deal with that in any of the grapes and the bottlings that you produce at Tablas Creek?
Well, we actually decided in 2003 that we wanted to have all of the Chateau Neuf varieties as well as some of the non-Chateau Neuf grapes that we grow, like Viognier and Marsan, that are allowed across the border in Côte du Rhône but not allowed in Chateau Neuf du Pape. So we now have 16 different grape varieties that we get to deal with, some of which we know well and some of which we're getting to know because we've only had a harvest or two off of them.
Yeah, astonishing. When you think about the history of the Rhône and the hundreds of years that they've dealt with, maybe 1,000, who knows. And here we're considered venerable on the central coast at Tablas Creek, right? And how many years have you been here?
We started in 89. Our first harvest wasn't really till 97. So
well, there you are.
Pretty recent.
Yeah, it's amazing. Daniel Dow is also with us today. And Daniel, you are a fascinating guy for a number of different reasons, but one of them is that the property that you established in Paso Robles is in one of the most fascinating terroirs, I think, in the entire area. And part of it is venerable. You acquired a vineyard that was really quite special, as I recall.
The property. No, there was no vineyard, but yeah, the property.
The property, yeah.
Yeah.
And the location is something that you decided was going to be a remarkable location, and you've turned it into one. In fact, I'm standing. Look, some people would think I was standing. looking at a Dow, Paso Robles, Adelaida, Soul of the Lion, and I'm assuming that because of the nomenclature on this, it's a blend of Bordeaux varietals. Is
correct,
that correct?
Correct. Typically, it's Cabernet Sauvignon, mm-hmm. Cabernet Franc, and Le Petit Verdot. So I've kind of narrowed it down to the three varieties that I like for this blend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And by the way, by saying that you like them, it doesn't mean that you don't like the others.
Oh, no. Right? I like this blend with the three varieties, but I make other blends also with Bordeaux varieties, 98% of what I planted is Bordeaux varieties, and mostly Cabernet Sauvignon and a lot of Cabernet Franc, but some Merlot, some Petit Verdot, some Malbec, and Le Sauvignon Blanc and Le Sémillon as well. So we have a Le Syrah, a Le Chardonnay as well, but mostly 98% is Bordeaux varieties.
And what got you interested in that? I saw or heard that you were very fluent in French when you and Christian were conversing.
French.
You are French.
Yeah, I'm half French, yeah, but I grew up in France.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I had a Frenchman in the woodshed. That's where I got my palate. But I don't have that in my nomenclature. Archie Campbell McLaren is definitely not French. At any rate, when you were there, what was your family like in order to get you interested and involved in this food and wine and that culture?
You know, in France, we drink wine every day. And my parents drank wine every day. And
everyone?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Even when we were kids, we have a little wine with them. With my dad, and that's really where my passion started. But when I immigrated to the United States, I became a computer engineer, studied at the University of California, San Diego, and got my degree. But my passion has always been wine. So I was fortunate enough to retire at a young age and decided to pursue winemaking. So 8 years of studying and being mentored by two great winemakers, and the rest is history. This will be my 12th harvest in Paso.
Yeah. Well, the property that you have appears to be facing in both directions of that ridge. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's something very unique about the property we're facing, that we have. So we have 212 acres on the estate. The soil is exactly the same soil as you find in Saint-Emilion, or for that matter, in Burgundy. It's calcareous clay, which is going to give you great minerality, but it's also, these soils are very much depleted of potassium. So the beautiful thing about this, which is unlike a lot of regions that grow Cabernet Sauvignon in California, we can hang as long as we want and never have to acidulate, which is a big plus. It's natural acidity into the wines, as well as minerality. And the other thing that's unique about it is we are pretty much the highest elevation in Paso Robles. We're close to 2,100, 2,200 feet.
Yeah, for our listeners, this is west of 101.
Yeah, that's in the Adelaida district, which is west of 101, about 8 miles west.
Mm-hmm.
And the temperature, we don't reach a lot of, a lot of days over 100 degrees. As a matter of fact, I map the temperature every year and compare it to different regions. On a yearly basis, we pretty much match St. Helena and Napa. yeah. in terms of average temperature, in terms of number of days over 100 degrees. So quite a bit, you know, fewer days than, say, the airport downtown, which averages 30 or more days over 100 degrees. We typically are around 3 to 7, depending on the year. And that the combination of being able to achieve ripeness, great climate, and great soil for natural acidity not only drives with it, especially with the intensity of the sun at 2,200 feet and the steep slopes, give you intense phenolics. The Cabernet Sauvignon that we make on our mountain, according to Wine X-Ray in Napa, is one of the highest phenolically rich Cabernet Sauvignon they've ever seen.
It is remarkable, no doubt.
So you've got the phenolics, you've got the balance, you've got the minerality, and the rest is up to the winemaker, I guess, to do a good job in balancing out all these elements.
Yeah, well, I knew Andrei Chelyshev reasonably well, and it was fascinating to me that he, as an expert, a true genius intuitively and from the standpoint of experience and whatever way you want to look at it, had told Don Chapelet that to make the greatest wine in the Napa Valley, you had to be at the top of a hill or a mountain. And so Chapelet acquired Pritchard Hill.
Yes,
and that's where all their grapes come from. And they had a wine come out in Wine Spectator recently actually from Parker, that was 99+. That's a pretty good score. In fact, Chelyshev was probably accurate. It seemed to be at any rate. And so that was something that influenced you and your choice.
Yes, actually, if you look at the history of winemaking in Paso, the first commercial winery in Paso Robles was established on our property by Dr. Hoffman.
Oh, HMR.
Correct. Yeah, right. And at the time, Chelyshev came in and recommended planting Cabernet Sauvignon, which was actually the first planting of Cabernet Sauvignon on the Central Coast. And then Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and on the north-facing slopes, which we don't have. Yeah. So that's the history of Paso. But I'd like to touch on 2015, actually, because I've got a lot of information I'd love to share with you.
Oh, please do. And Brian, we'll get back to you shortly, because we're not done with you yet.
So, all right, I'm still here.
First of all, a year ago, I told a lot of people that 2014 was my best vintage ever. I had made my best wines. And I'm very pleased today, because harvest is over today for me, I'm very pleased to say that I will deliver 2015 wines that rival 2014.
You mean literally today was your last day of harvest?
Yes, today we crushed. It was the last day. Right. Our mountain was harvested over a month ago, but we have other grapes coming from the rest of Paso, and they basically linger a little bit longer, which is what we've been harvesting. But the quality of the wine is fantastic. That being said, there were many challenges in 2015, and I'm really curious to see if you've experienced the same challenges. Starting with a very warm winter, I think we all experienced that. As Jason was saying, we ended up in May having a very, very cold May. We had highs in the 40s on our mountain. Wow. So the flowering process did not go very successfully, and many berries were aborted. But that's a typical shadow situation. But I think this year was something a little worse than that. And I noticed it around June timeframe. Not only did the flowering process, did not go through well and a lot of berries were aborted, but a lot of berries developed at a different speed, at a different pace. So by the time you got to harvest, you had not only just shot berries and berries that were, on their way to being physiologically ripe, but you had berries that were behind by a week or two, which is a big problem. Because, what happens when you go to harvest, you can sort out the shot berries. You can sort out the cluster that didn't perform well. But how do you sort out 10 berries out of 20 or 25 that look like they're behind? You cannot do that.
Good point.
It's humanly impossible. So I noticed that around June, and I got very concerned because I knew our crop was going to be very low, but I had no way how to deal with this problem. So I made a very quick decision, which I think paid off for us. I went ahead and acquired the first optical sorting system in Paso Robles from Palenque.
Oh, yeah. I saw one at Opus One not long ago.
Yeah, it's the Palenque. It works extremely well. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting is when we first started getting our berries and I put it through the optical sorting system, it would reject what I was looking at, full berries that looked very nice. And at first, my first thought was, this machine is stupid. It doesn't know what it's doing. And then I started taking out these berries and I would crack them open and those seeds were 100% green and tart and they were awful. And then I would flash a light on them, and if you really look closely, they were actually slightly discolored. So I had the optical sorting system working on the highest setting it had to eliminate anything that is even close to discoloration. So on top of being, probably 50 to 80% down on the in terms of number of berries per cluster and number of clusters, et cetera, in the blocks. I eliminated probably another 20% of these berries that were totally whole when I was going to the optical sorting system.
Wow.
The long and the short of it were pretty much down, depending on the block, between 50 and 80% down from normal. The good news is we had another 40 acres come online this year, so that helped us at least hopefully have enough wine to ship to our club members and hopefully have in the tasting room. So but overall, the yields were extremely low. But that optical sorting system really helped us not get in trouble in terms of flavors, because what we have this year is a situation where you've got pHs that are a little bit higher, but you've got acidity that's also a little higher. And if you kept these berries in and you didn't eliminate them, you're going to have a problem where you have pHs of 3.8, 3.85, but then you have TAs of 0.9, which is very hard to deal with. I mean, you can deal with it, but then you have to resort to really, you know, changing the wine and manipulating the wine, which is a situation we never like to be in. Mm-hmm. So that's one situation we ran into that was very challenging, and we overcame it. The second thing that I noticed this year that was very different, and I'm really curious if you got the same experience, is typically in Paso you have an alcohol conversion factor of about 0.59. So, for instance, if you're at, you know, 24.5 bricks, you're going to end up with 14.5% alcohol. You take 24.5, you multiply by 0.59, you get to about that number. If you're at 25.7, you're going to be at 15.2. That's typically how winemakers like to start as a starting basis. You know, if they get grapes that are a little bit higher in bricks, they're able to adjust that. This year, to my surprise, I think the conversion factors, not only in Paso, but I've talked to a few winemakers in Napa and in Marin County, and they were experiencing the same thing. They were closer to about 0.48 to 0.55. So if you thought you were making an alcohol wine with alcohol of 15% alcohol, you could be at 13 or 13.5. We have some alcohols that were at 12.5. So overall, I'm seeing much lower alcohol conversion factors. So I think overall, you're going to see alcohols that are lower across the board. You're going to see higher acidity. But phenolically speaking, the wines are tremendous. I mean, the phenolic levels we've reached this year pretty much rival 2014, which is a very nice year.
Tell all of our listeners what a phenolic level is comprised of.
So the best way I can describe this is the phenolic measurements are a very scientific way of measuring basically what's in that grape. However, you know, without writing a thesis about this and spending hours talking about every type of phenolic compounds that you can find in the grape, let's narrow it down to basically two. And two that really are going to help you determine how good of a vintage it is and how good of a terroir it is. One is anthocyanins, which is color, and there are different types of anthocyanins. There are total types of anthocyanin, which is the overall color that's available in that wine. But there's also the bound anthocyanin, which is the stabilized color. It's when the anthocyanin molecule attaches itself to the tannin molecule and becomes stable. So this is something that I often see, which is I've created a whole winemaking technique and a yeast to actually help me, you know, improve that whole phenolic experience. And the way I go about it is, if you have a lot of phenolics but they're not stable, that's when you go out and buy a bottle of wine and it's very dark, but then 5 years later you go to try it and the color's depleted. Because bound color, bound anthocyanins, is stable for many, many years to come. If the color is not stable, you may bottle it at a certain number, you know, level of anthocyanins or color, but then it depletes very rapidly. So within a few years, you deplete all this color. But that's one thing you look at. The second thing you look at is tannins. Tannins are very important because they're going to give you an idea on structure, on ageability, but more importantly, as far as we're concerned, is on mouthfeel. So when you measure the tannins and you look at the overall phenols, you're able to really look at how good your mouthfeel of your wines is going to be.
I see.
But to put it in a simple layman's terms, phenolics are for us not the all in all, but it's another tool that we use that allows us to figure out how good the vintage was or how good the terroir was. And these are very objective ways of looking at things.
I see.
And 2015, phenolically, was extremely rich.
So you sound optimistic, irrespective
extremely.
Of the challenges.
There were challenges, but as long as a winemaker overcame the challenges, I think he or she had a great chance of making great wines.
I see. Brian, let me ask you a question again. You heard what Daniel just described. How would you feel about the same sort of subject with respect to Arroyo Grande and your vineyard?
Well, I mean, first of all, Daniel has a much more technical approach than we do. We don't measure phenolics the same way. In terms of alcohol conversion, I would say our alcohols this year have been pretty consistent with what we've seen really over the past couple of years, so far. And, my general sense is I think it's going to be a good vintage, but time will really tell in terms of its age-worthiness and how it's going to hold up.
Yeah. How do you feel about it, Jason?
I think it's early to start making judgments one way or the other. In general, you look at your concentration in terms of what your yields are per acre you have, and we ended up just over 2 tons an acre this year, which is one of the lowest levels that we've ever had. We normally aim for something right around 3. So I think we're going to have good concentration. The numbers overall look solid. The sugars are down a little bit at harvest compared to the last couple of years, but within range. The flavors seem good at this stage. We try to avoid making too many conclusions this early because we just have to go back and make them again. Mm-hmm. We'll look in the spring when things are done with their primary and their malolactic fermentations and we get ready to start blending.
Well, from what I've heard today from Clendenin and Marjoram and all of you is that basically it's guardedly optimistic to a certain extent, although it's maybe a little more positive than just guardedly optimistic. I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens with these wines.
I do think it's really a vintage where expertise in the vineyard and in the cellar is going to play a critical role. I feel like we've had a couple of years in 13 and 14 where, the conditions were stacked in your favor to make great wines.
Yeah.
I think the potential is there for you to make great wines in 15, maybe even greater than what we've seen in the past couple of years. But there are also probably more pitfalls than there have been the past couple.
I see. Yeah.
I'd like to just one quick thing. It's fascinating, Dan, when you were talking about the optical sorting system. What we did in here, what I've noticed, the biggest difference is from vines to vines. One vine was a lot riper than some others. So what we did in several varietals was actually at 2 different picks. We would pick the cluster from really healthy vines that were ripe, we picked that up and left the other one behind. And that those early pick will be the cuvee, the better wine, so to speak, and then we had a second pick. So we didn't physically sort it in berry by berry, but we did per plant. And I think that was, as you said, Jason, it was very important to be in the vineyards every day and to make those decisions because the conditions were unusual.
Yeah. I mean, we took 6 passes through one Roussan block, picking, leaving it, picking,
and you, Daniel?
We drop a lot of fruit, but the other thing that's, we dry farm. We try to dry farm every year most of the vineyard. We either dry farm or deficit irrigated. The other thing I was going to mention is we got almost 2 inches of rain in July, which is I've never seen rain in July in Paso. Mm-hmm. And that allowed us to really dry farm a lot of the blocks this year, 100% all the way, which was great.
Well, I can hardly wait to taste some wines. I'm so thrilled that you guys would join me today. And Doug and Jim and Brian, thank you, Brian. It's been a real treat for me.
Great to be here.
And speaking of treats, I can tell you right now, the one I'm looking at, which was not offered to me, by the way, 2012 Dow Solo Lion blend of Bordeaux varietals. I suggest somebody have that one.
You. It's
okay.
Yours.
You talked me into it.
I brought it for you.
This is Archie McLaren for KCBX Public Radio. Thank you.